The Paleo Manifesto. Now, there's a man, John Durant. He lives in Manhattan, but he is actually, he doesn't like to be called a caveman, but he's a paleolith. I guess that's fair to say. He runs barefoot through Central Park and that sort of thing, and eats only fruits and nuts, and I don't know if he actually hunts and gathers in Central Park. We'll find out. He's online with us from New York. John Durant, how are you, John?
I'm here.
How are you? Pretty good?
I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, good. So this all started because of you had a job that was driving you crazy and making you drink and eat and causing you stress?
Yeah, I think it's a typical experience for people at their first desk job. Their health sort of hits a wall. Wow. And then I didn't want to just do some goofy calorie counting weight loss diet and stumbled on this evolutionary approach.
Nothing goofy, just the caveman lifestyle.
Right. Nothing goofy about being a caveman in New York City.
How tired are you of hearing the caveman thing? That's got to be tiresome.
Oh, I've been getting caveman jokes for about 7 years. The problem is, if I get defensive, that's what the Geico cavemen do, and so I can't get defensive about it.
I know. So, did they rip you off, the Geico people?
You know, the caveman thing has been going back. You know, they've been doing jokes about that since the Flintstones and before.
Yeah.
So I don't have any trademark on it.
Yeah. Isn't it true? I mean, living in Manhattan is sort of like living in caves, isn't it? Everyone's in their own little cave.
It's a good insight. It's all the urbanites here and these tiny concrete apartments that are really cave-like.
Yeah, and they're stacked up. So many more people should probably be doing this in here. Now you run barefoot through Central Park. Does that get a lot of attention or?
It did a few years ago before the book Born to Run was a big hit. And so initially it was children grabbing their parents and saying, "Oh my God, what is that crazy person doing?"
Yeah.
And now people just say, "Oh, gross."
and the fact that they can't hear you coming up behind them, is that upsetting to some other runners and passersby?
Yes, you have to make sure not to scare people too much.
Yeah. What is the art to running barefoot? Not everyone. I mean, if you're used to running in shoes, there's a difference, isn't there?
Yeah, the main difference is that these modern running shoes often have a thick heel, which encourages us to land on our heel, what's called a heel strike. And this can end up, a lot of the science is starting to show, this can end up causing damage to your knee and ankles and shins and things like that. The point isn't that everybody needs to take off their shoes and always be barefoot or run barefoot or anything like that. It's that we need to realize that the natural human stride is probably more gentle with a gentle forefoot strike rather than a heel strike.
Yeah. I read something recently about the arch on the foot that actually comes from hanging on vines, or it's designed for hanging on vines. Did you see that?
I did not see that. I mean, there's been enough time of bipedalism where it's well adapted to supporting our weight, and our toes are different lengths than chimpanzees and things like that. So.
No, I've noticed that too. Although the Cleveland Zoo was instrumental in all this, right? The primate house, the gorillas of the Cleveland Zoo was kind of inspirational for you?
Yeah, I go on a trip to the... See, if you start a health book talking about human beings, you can't get any agreement because everybody has their own opinions and it's hard to put those biases aside.
Yeah.
So I went to the Cleveland Zoo and they shifted the gorilla diet from basically some processed fiber bars made out of wheat, corn, and soy to leafy vegetables closer to what the gorillas would eat in the wild. And miracle of miracles, one of them loses 50 pounds, the other loses 30 pounds, the behavioral problems go away. And that's the approach they take in zoos. They combine the best of modern medical technology, and then to prevent chronic health conditions, they mimic relevant aspects of the animal's natural habitat. Yeah.
The irony is you can buy gorilla bars now. They're sort of tasty. I don't care for them.
I've had one. The ones I had were very bland. They did not taste. I called them fiber bars from hell.
Yeah. Did you see also that there's this, just came out, this thing about Neanderthals ate stomach goop and you can too? Did you happen to see that?
I did see that. That was interesting. And there was also one of the big microbiome organizations was looking at hunter-gatherers, and they would eat stomach contents. The Hadza in Tanzania would eat the stomach contents of their prey, and they would, you know, we think about washing our hands to get germs off. Mm-hmm. They would actually take the stomach contents and rub them all over their hands to basically take the microorganisms from the animal they just killed.
So to acquire bacteria.
To acquire bacteria.
Interesting. How did that work out for them? I mean, is there a benefit to that? Because there are good bacteria, as we all know, but...
Right. I mean, they're a pretty healthy people, and we've realized that we overdid it in the war against microorganisms, and we overtake antibiotics and things like that. So we need to. What will become common? Dan Lieberman, a Harvard professor who has a book out too, he just suggested this. It'll be common after people get a course of antibiotics to have a course of probiotics to help people reestablish healthy microorganisms in their stomach and in their body after killing a lot off.
Yeah. Well, is it called CHYME? Is that right? CHYME? Is that CHYME?
The stomach stuff? You know, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Because Friedhof Nansen, 1893, ate Inuit reindeer chyme and said that has undergone a sort of stewing in the process of semi-digestion, while the gastric juice provides a somewhat sharp and aromatic sauce. Many will no doubt make a wry face at the thought of this dish, but they really need not do so. I have tasted it, found it not uneatable. So that's sort of a recommendation, although somewhat sour, like fermented milk. So, I don't know, is that popular now? Is there, are people, is that being served at fancy Manhattan eateries?
Not yet.
Stomach
not
chime.
Yet. Though in Iceland you can get the rotten shark's head.
Oh, yeah.
They bury it underground for a long time, then dig it up, and it's been fermenting nicely. I'm sure it has a nice smell.
Now, have you traveled widely and studied various types of people to arrive at your paleo diet and so forth and lifestyle?
You know, I didn't have the opportunity to actually go live with an indigenous tribe. The sad thing is there aren't that many left, and there's so much contact with outsiders that, you know, it's fewer tribes every year and fewer people. I would love to do that at some point, but I did the adventure at the zoo. I got a tour of Harvard's fossil archive to examine Paleolithic fossils and skeletons and skulls and compare them to the farmers that came afterwards. And the farmers were shorter and had terrible teeth and all these signs of disease on their bones and things like that. So I did get to do that.
Yeah. So a lot of this is just basically avoid farming, right? And a lot of farmers would feel the same way, I think, at this point, given, you know, the way it's going.
It suggests that all these grains that have come to dominate modern diets have some drawbacks. You know, they're not evil. I don't want to start another, you know, fad diet where telling people that you can only eat these foods and not those foods. I'm not sure that's helpful. But all this wheat, corn, and soy that we're consuming, either directly or in the processed foods in the middle of the grocery store or the feed that's fed to industrial animals, really means that for most people, wheat, corn, and soy is the staple of their diet, and there's some drawbacks when you eat so much of those seeds.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have to actually go out? I mean, do you hunt and gather in Central Park, if that's legal, or did you have to go out and learn how to hunt, for example?
I did. I didn't do it in Central Park, which you can run into some issues there. I went deer hunting in Michigan, where I'm from, and shot my first deer. So that was it was, you know, it's, if you haven't done it before, it's, as other authors have written, like Michael Pollan, it can be a very moving experience.
Yeah, was it a problem for you? I mean, how did you do?
I did fine.
I mean, emotionally, you know.
I shot Bambi. I shot a male yearling. So that but it was one shot. It was a clean kill. Field dressed it on the spot. Helped butcher it. Cooked it for others. Shared it. And it was a great experience. I didn't have it. It wasn't hugely I'm not an enormously emotional person, so it wasn't a very there were no tears, it was a very respectful activity.
Yeah. Did you find it curiously satisfying?
You know, just like growing vegetables in your own garden,
yeah.
It just tastes better. This sounds a little diabolical to say, but animals that you kill yourself also taste better.
Yeah.
But you're connected to it. You look it in the eye. You're a part of the food system. You're moving closer to the food system, not farther away from it. And it, you know, it's very much the circle of life sort of ethic.
Yeah. So were there any, like, Paleolithic vegetarians? Or were there vegetarian tribes?
There weren't.
No.
I mean, not if you go far enough back in our lineage, where we diverge with chimpanzees, we were mostly frugivores, fruit-eating, but even chimpanzees eat some meat. There are no known vegetarian indigenous populations, so it's fair to say that we're adapted to eating meat.
Mm. Is there a movement now to kill only invasive species, if necessary?
It's a burgeoning movement. I wouldn't say it's huge, but it's a way... It's a way in whether it's eating Asian carp that's, you know, starting to get into the Great Lakes, or people cooking kudzu in the South, that green vine that
right, it's everywhere.
Overtakes everything. This is a way in which hunters, invasivores, can play a very important role in the food system to keep these singularly invasive species from despoiling the habitat.
And I know you're opposed to industrial foods of any sort, right, or processes. But what about the 3D printed meat? are there possibilities here? Because this could actually meet a lot of...
I'm in favor of innovation and entrepreneurs experimenting. We need to make sure we're not too hubristic. There are... Whenever we try to re-engineer something, it may work for, you know, 9 times out of 10, but the 10th time it may fail spectacularly. Or the history of food is us re-engineering things and not realizing that there were drawbacks.
Mm-hmm.
From the original farmers domesticating wheat, and so I'm just concerned that we're going to make some changes, and there's going to be an unanticipated drawback that we didn't see.
Yeah, but it would ease some qualms, perhaps, about the source of it. If it comes from a printer, how bad can it be? No animal actually died to produce this meat.
Correct. For ethical issues, absolutely. I think there'll probably be some health things that have to be overcome. I'm starting to advise a company called Exo that is pioneering cricket-based foods.
Oh.
And there are really amazing health, ethical, and environmental reasons that we should be eating more insects. Everybody gets grossed out by that, but even under kosher law, halal, crickets, grasshoppers, locusts are considered clean. Most cultures around the world do eat some type of insects. The amino acid profile is amazing. They're accustomed to living in close quarters. They don't require a lot of resources. So there are a lot of arguments, and the main argument against them is gross.
I noticed, actually, speaking of kosher law, that comes up. The kosher laws come up quite a bit in the book, and the law of Moses is hand washing, which I didn't – is that like the 11th commandment, wash your hands? I wasn't aware of that one.
I really wasn't either. There's a chapter on infectious disease exploding and how early religions, particularly Judaism, were in many ways cultural adaptations to disease. It when you think about hand washing, it is the simplest, most effective, cheapest form of hygiene ever discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And there are three... injunctions for either Jewish priests or Jewish people to wash their hands in the Torah. And you know, scholars have argued throughout the years of whether this, how ritualistic this was, or whether it had an actual hygienic function. But the point of view that I really push in that chapter is, it instead of thinking that we needed to wash our hands in order to pray, perhaps prayer emerged as a mechanism to get people to wash their hands.
Yes, no, you're serious. Okay, that's entirely possible.
I'm serious. I mean, think about the Sabbath. The Sabbath is basically a time every 7 days when a very clean God wants everyone to come to his very clean temple and wash their hands, bathe, wash their clothes, clean their house. And if you don't do this, then you die or you get excluded from the community. So it just in a very similar dynamic to parents telling a child to brush their teeth.
Yeah.
And the child's like, oh, I don't want to brush my teeth. Well, why do I have to? Well, there are these invisible things.
God says things.
Yeah. Right. So that's what I explore in that chapter.
Yeah. Moses came down and said, and by the way, brush your teeth. That's
well, when you put yourself 3,000 years ago, and people, you can't see germs, and they spread in such ingenious ways, and infectious disease is the number one cause of mortality. People are just dropping dead. You don't know what's killing them, and you think the gods are killing them. You think that they're being struck down for doing something wrong or evil. And so the early notions of sin in Judaism and in Zoroastrianism and some other early religions, early notions of sin were very closely tied to hygienic or unhygienic behavior. So I'm not the first. I mean, that's one of the oldest themes in scholarship. I'm not the first to point that out.
And, of course, circumcision, which, you know, there's got to be a reason for it. There's not an advantage to it otherwise, you know, so there must be a reason for it.
There's lots of scientific papers that on how Jewish women have throughout history had very low rates of cervical cancer. Cervical cancer is caused by the human papillomavirus, and they've found that circumcision is an effective method of reducing transmission of HPV.
Yeah.
It doesn't reduce transmission of all STDs, but it does reduce transmission of that one.
Small consolation, but still. You know. For the male, I mean, not for the female, it's great. Then this other thing I have, you know, I mean, people will say, well, okay, Paleolithic, that's great, and maybe the eating actually would be better and a lot. But, you know, they live to what, age 35 or something? How old are you right now?
I'm 30.
You're 30.
So I only have 5 years left.
You got 5 years left on this particular lifestyle, so.
I'll switch when I'm 34.
your next big thing, right?
That's right. Well, look, some of that was just infant mortality. And a lot of people were dying of things that don't kill us today, whether it's wild animals, exposure to the elements, you break your arm, you know, that could be a death sentence. When it comes, what we struggle with today is chronic health conditions. Mm. And when you look at indigenous populations, Paleolithic hunter-gatherers, or just wild animals living in their natural habitat, they're not obese, they're not getting diabetes, their teeth aren't perfect, but they're pretty darn good, they don't have to go to the dentist. So when it comes to chronic health conditions, we can learn a lot from this evolutionary Paleolithic way of living.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, I know you'd recommend a polar bear plunge and a schwitz afterwards. Is that basically a good thing to do?
Well, I'm wearing my polar bear, Coney Island Polar Bear Club sweatshirt right now. Our lives have become very monotonous and very temperature controlled. We move from car to office to home, or really from home to car to office. And it's pretty much the same temperature all the time. And there's some interesting studies that suggest that never being cold may partly have caused the rise of obesity. And so temperature variation can be very healthy. It helps reduce inflammation. The Spartans were avid users of a early sauna after their athletic contests. athletes today will do hot and cold extremes, which can be very beneficial. And then even our internal temperature, when people get a fever, that's an elevated body temperature. It's an adaptive response by the body to fight infection. And so these days, everybody, as soon as they get a fever, they immediately start popping medications, which can relieve some of the symptoms, but they're realizing that when you lower someone's fever, it can oftentimes extend the illness. So one of the lessons here when we think about temperature is realizing that some of this variation can be a good thing, both in our external habitat and in our internal bodily temperature.
Mm-hmm. Have you flirted with being a neolith?
I am a neolith. I take the best of the old with the best of the new. That's really what I'm about.
So it's really the Neolith manifesto.
No, that's my sequel. I need something to write after
your first book, obviously. You know, they solved some of the problems that the Paleolithic people had in the Neolithic. Are we still in the Neolithic period, or are we in something else now?
As I refer to it, I say Paleolithic age, agricultural age, industrial age, and now we're in the information age. Because Paleolithic is old stone age, and Neolithic is new stone age, and we're not about the stones anymore.
Not so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, less than the other thing is this. I mean, you do this killer cardio thing, don't you? I mean, this, what's it called, CrossFit? Isn't it? I mean, that's like killer. Each day is a different killer cardio thing, right?
I think being sedentary every day is crazy.
I don't take that personally. I think you're right.
It's intense by design. It doesn't appeal to everyone. It tends to appeal to very competitive personalities that thrive on team sports and things like that.
Yeah.
And what it's very good at, people can argue about optimal exercise protocol until the cows come home. Should I do 3 sets of 10 or 10 sets of 3 or whatever?
Yeah.
It's very good at motivating people. And that's actually the big challenge of our era. We don't need some new contraption in the gym that is going to collect dust. We don't need some new exercise video or, you know, some gimmicky thing. The real fundamental issue why people don't move anymore is because we've lost the reason, the motivation to move. We don't have to. So any type of fitness regimen that motivates people effectively, it could be yoga, it could be CrossFit, it could be running, really is the most important thing.
Right. And would we still find you sprinting on your treadmill at the gym? Is that?
I don't work out at a conventional gym anymore, so I'll actually go out on the street in New York and do some sprints. Sometimes I use a rowing machine at CrossFit. I do some barefoot runs in the park. I really mix it up. Again,
yes.
Variety. If you look at hunter gatherers in the wild, they're not running in a straight line on a flat surface at the same speed over and over again.
No.
Every day they're sometimes sprinting. There's a ton of walking. Women and are digging up tubers from the ground, which is actually a very difficult thing to do. And walking 4 miles with their kids, with a child in one arm and food in the other, and so just very, very active, people. So we can learn a lot from them.
So what do you have for dinner tonight?
What am I having? Yeah. I haven't killed it yet, so I don't know. I'll probably have, let's see, what do I have in the fridge? I'll probably make myself a burger without the bun, a grass-fed burger with some lettuce, tomato, onion, pickles, and a little side salad, and maybe some, I think I have cauliflower. So
yeah.
I
could live with
thinks,
that. That's not so radical.
It's not.
No stomach
thinks,
contents or anything?
that I've become a carnivore, and I actually don't eat more meat than I used to eating a conventional diet. I've basically stopped eating wheat, corn, and soy pretty much, and I've substituted more vegetables in their place.
Well, it's very interesting, I must say, and I'm taking some of this to heart. Not the movie much, but I recommend it, The Paleo Manifesto, Ancient Wisdom for Lifelong Health, John Durant. John, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay.
It was fun.
Yeah. We'll look for you on the streets of New York. Okay. Interesting. Paleolithic lifestyle. I'm living some sort of a lithic. I'm not sure which one it is. Paleolithium. I'm living paleolithium lifestyle.
Paleolithium?
Yeah.
That's another book altogether.
How are you there? Are you still working out at all? Are you
doing
anything? Yeah. And you had a diet that was actually very good for you. That was
I still do.
You dropped a lot of those carbohydrates and things. And
yeah. No, he's right though about the wheat and corn and those types of grains. I think.
But didn't they have wheat and corn when they were out hunting and gathering? Didn't they run into corn or wheat?
Probably not as much.
No. That's a recent invention. Yes, do you know?
It's around, but it took a lot of work
to
process.
It was around, but it took work to process.
And so
okay.
You go towards eating vegetables first.
Okay. Well, they must occasionally run, like in Kansas, if you're a Paleolithic man in Kansas, you're going to run into a wheat field. What do you
do
with it? You
probably can make a different beer. Kind of wheat, too. I think they
make. I mean, you can make, you know, I think they made beer originally, which has got to be a good use of that, of the grain thing, because it's.
I'd have to agree there.
Less harmful if made into alcohol, I think.
I don't know if there's any science behind that, but I'm just going to go with it.
Science.
You know,
come on. Have another glass. All right, so, okay, here, we get a little song. That's just coming up here.
Hi,
Jeff, by the way. I don't mean to ignore you.
Hey, Michael.
Jeff, doesn't Jeff look like a pumpkin?
The shirt, you mean the shirt, then he's got the orange shirt,
the orange,
and then he's got an orange and black kind of shirt. It's cute. It's good. So, kids going out for trick-or-treat? And
yes, twice.
Twice?
Once today and then once on Thursday.
Really?
Wow.
Is that for religious reasons or something? They go out twice?
Elm Grove trick-or-treat.
Oh, it's Elm Grove reasons. Okay.
Okay. They go around to different cities and, you know.
Yeah. And did they make their own costumes? Did your wife help them or did you help them? Yeah.
Half and half.
Yeah. What are we going as this year?
My daughter is Marie Antoinette.
Marie Antoinette. Well, that's a natural for her. That really is perfect. Cade's a ninja.
Aiden is a pirate.
Arr. Sounds cool. Everyone is according to type. Sounds great. All right, we got here this little tune.
So there's a little Halloween tune called The Great Pumpkin Waltz.
Sounds good.